Well, coming up on the local news hour, right after some local news. Yep, I just said that. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher discusses the agenda for Wednesday's county council meeting. The Utah State Board of Education member Carol Lear will be talking about some of this year's ballot measures affecting education, and we'll have an update on COVID-19 impacts in schools. And at 8:45, we're going to have the director of the Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, join us to discuss some open space issues. Well, the Park City COVID-19 testing locations are moving indoors today to prepare for the cold weather. KBCW's Jessica Lowell explains.
Since May, Intermountain Healthcare and the University of Utah Health have been working together to test patients at the Intermountain Park City Hospital. Those tests have been administered at drive-in clinics in the parking lot. But starting Tuesday, there'll be no more outdoor testing. The U of U will provide testing inside at the Redstone Health Center, and testing hours will be from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Sunday. And starting Wednesday, the hospital will also resume testing indoors. Their hours of operation will be Monday through Sunday from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. daily. Kylene Metzger is with the U of U Health. She says moving indoors won't change the safety of testing.
There's a lot of speculation around it, but for all of our sites where we're moving indoors, we're having a completely separate area for non-respiratory and respiratory patients.
Both facilities have moved to saliva-based COVID-19 tests. Metzger says that will also help keep medical personnel safe.
So instead of like the nasal swab where the medical assistant was actually doing it themselves, they're just handing the test tube over to the patient, and after they spit, they'll give it back to the medical personnel.
Appointments are required to get screened at Redwood, but are not required at Intermountain. All tests are free, even for people without insurance. If you think you could have COVID-19, you can visit Intermountain or the U's website to check for criteria to get tested. You can find links and more details on our website, kpcw.org. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, good morning. On the line, I've got Summit County Manager Tom Fisher to discuss the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So, this week, the council will be interviewing six candidates for the Snyderville Planning Commission. This is to replace Canis Hart, who is leaving. But will you not have another vacancy to replace Melina Stevens, who is also on the Planning Commission? She's running for county council on the November ballot and has no opponent, so she will be filling that seat.
Yeah, at this point, we don't know at what point before the end of the year or before she's... apparently she will be sworn in the first meeting in January, so we don't know when that resignation will happen. It's likely that we will open up again for interviews and recruitment for that position, but we'll see what the council does here.
Mm-hmm. And there will be a discussion of voting options in Summit County for the election next month. Can you give us a little bit of information on that?
Absolutely. And, you know, it has about four parts to it. So, you know, early voting, in-person voting starts on the 20th of the month. It goes through the 30th. It's open at the clerk's office at the Summit County Courthouse in Colville. So business days and business hours between the 20th and the 30th of October. As well, mail ballots, which, you know, all registered voters will get a mailed ballot and can vote by mail. Those will be mailed on October 13th. They should arrive in mailboxes by about the 18th of October at the latest. If you're going to vote by mail, it needs to be postmarked. If you're going to put it in the mail to return it, it needs to be postmarked on or before November 2nd. But we also have drop box locations all over the county. There's one at Colville City Hall. There's one at the clerk's office in the courthouse in Colville. The Camas County Services Building, Park City Hall, the Richens Building or the library at Kimball Junction. The Jeremy Pinebrook Fresh Market has a drop box. And the market in Park City has a drop box. All of those locations are available until 8 p.m. on November 3rd to drop your ballot, and they will be collected at that time. And then, of course, the day of the election, November 3rd, there will be drive-up voting assistance available at the fairgrounds in Colville. That's where the polling, the live polling place will be for the November 3rd election.
Mm-hmm. And is that drive-up voter assistance center, is that a new thing, or has that been in elections in the past as well?
Well, normally we would have a polling place in the courthouse, but because of COVID, we're doing this so that we can make it a little safer for those that want to vote in that way.
Mm-hmm. And so the big item on the agenda is the Dakota Pacific mixed-use community proposed for Kimball Junction. Obviously, that's been a big project.
I would argue that all the things on the agenda are big items. That is one of them. You're right.
Of course. So do you have any estimate of how many work sessions there will be on this project, and how soon will the council hold a public hearing on this?
Yeah, so of course, this is a work session item, so it's not a public hearing. There's about 90 minutes dedicated to staff and the developer or the applicant to introduce the project to the council. I think there will be some discussion on schedule during the meeting. There's no way to predict how many meetings the council will want to deliberate on this or when public hearings will start.
Right. And then the Snyderville Commission in September voted 5-2 to forward a negative recommendation on this. How does that complicate this process?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a consideration for the council. It is a recommendation. So now the council takes a new look at this. Can weigh all of those things that are brought into the process. I don't know that you're going to see a lot of discussion about the merits of the project in work session this week. Usually the way the council handles these is to wait till they have a public comment and public hearings to really get into those types of things.
Mm-hmm. And this is the council's first official introduction to the project, is that correct?
That is correct.
Right. And do you believe that the council will come to a decision on this before the end of the year? Or if it drags into January, we mentioned before Melina Stevens would be joining the council. Does that raise any sort of legal entanglements?
It does not. We've actually talked about that with the attorney's office, and I think I'd rather defer the official answer to that to the attorney's office, since they're the official answer as far as land use matters. But so far, I have not heard anything that would complicate it. It's hard to tell whether this will be a decision during this year or next. The council's schedule is extremely busy through the end of the year because we're getting into the time where they're considering the 2021 budget. And there are still a lot of things that need to get done between now and mid-December when they have their last meeting.
Right. And so the council will actually meet with the Snyderville Planning Commission towards the end of the meeting. You like to meet, the council likes to meet with the Planning Commission on a periodic basis. Do you think the council will ask the Snyderville planners their opinions on Dakota Pacific?
I have no idea what's going to come up in that. I mean, it's clearly there's a lot of different issues in front of the Planning Commission right now, now that they've gotten past their recommendation with Dakota Pacific. It's possible that could come up. Certainly the Planning Commission has dealt with that issue extensively, but there are a lot of other issues, other developments that are coming forward, although they usually cannot talk specifically about those. They may also talk about different items of code that they've noticed over the year. Either the Planning Commission or the Council, that they'd like the planning staff and the Commission to look at as they go into the new year and with a new Planning Commission.
All right. So quickly before you go, we hear that the county's sustainability director, Lisa Yoder, is retiring at the end of the year. Any words you want to say about her, Tom?
Oh, man. Lisa has done so much to advance the council's climate goals, their sustainability goals, their ethic around environmental sustainability. Most notable is the fact that we're moving quickly towards having all of our government operations powered by renewable energy. And you know, that's a big swath or big swing at meeting our climate goals for the future. She's been instrumental in negotiating all that, or being part of the negotiations with our attorney's office and Rocky Mountain Power and the legislature, and getting legislation changed in order to make all that happen. We wouldn't have been able to do that without her. The next person that gets recruited to fill those shoes has got big shoes to fill. She's set a great example for all of us in the community on how to pursue these goals.
Sounds like she will be missed. Anything else you want to add before we let you go?
Just that we are recruiting also for a new member for the Snyderville Basin Recreation Board. You need to be a resident of the Snyderville Basin Recreation District, a primary resident and a registered voter. And that closes on October 14th. So we quite often have a lot of interest in those. So I wanted to make sure that we get that out there and make sure people can sign up for that. And they can do that on our website if you're interested.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Tom. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. Well, Summit County's community development staff see a variety of applicants come to the planning counter. Sometimes the applicant might even be the county itself. During his latest visit to KBCW, we asked Development Director Pat Putt how he handles that kind of situation. Rick Bruff has more.
Putt told KPCW that it's not unusual to see the county seeking some kind of development permit. For instance, for the creation of the Ecker Hill Park and Ride lot on Kilby Road. Putt said the same thing happened on occasion when he was planning director for Park City.
There were projects like the Main Street improvements in the historic district. There was certainly the Old Town Transit Center, the public works facility, the Sand Ridge lots. All of those were development projects that went through some sort of development permitting process in front of the planning commission, and in some instances in front of the, you know, the city council.
In a recent interview, private attorney Bruce Baird, a longtime foil for the county, now representing Hideout developer Nate Brodbank, blasted the idea that the county would be a developer, both a referee and a player, as he put it. Putt said he didn't hear Baird's remarks, but said the attorney raises a valid point. He said his response is to be fair to all stakeholders.
We owe it to both the citizens, the elected officials, you know, everybody involved in that there's fair access to that governmental process, whether it's in front of a historic district commission or a planning commission or a council, you know, that we have open meetings and there's adequate notice for those meetings and there's clear explanations of what's going to be discussed at those meetings. And then, you know, finally, when we're engaged in those discussions, it's important to be clear that, you know, we're applying the rules fairly to the local government as we would to any other private interest.
The issue comes up with the county's acquisition last year of the Florence Gilmore parcel along the Highway 40 frontage road. Of the 470 acres there, the county is considering 120 for development. Putt said they have made no decisions, but ideas for the parcel include a transit location, a public works facility, an expansion to the nearby Silver Creek Justice Center, or workforce housing. But given the impacts of COVID this year, developing that parcel has been on the back burner.
Doesn't mean that it's not important. Doesn't mean that we won't be picking it up. I just think that as we head into next year, beginning that 2021, I think we'll be sitting down with Tom Fisher and council and looking at our priorities. And we'll see where the Gilmore planning in that area ranks on those priority lists.
On a related topic, Putt said that permit activity may show a decrease from the previous year, but they're still busy in 2020. He said the staff are conducting 25 to 40 inspections a day, many of those large projects. One example he noted is the Discovery Residential development underway near the Wileman School on Kilby Road. He He said a number of units will likely get finished this year and have residents by Christmas. For KPCW, I'm Rick Braff.
Well, a man died at Wasatch Mountain State Park over the weekend. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has details.
The 61-year-old man, Anthony Patrick Dugmore, was found Sunday morning at 10 a.m. His body was next to his utility vehicle down a steep embankment. Dugmore was traveling alone on his UTV on a hunting trip Saturday and had contact with his family in the afternoon. But his family called authorities the following morning when he did not return home. Search parties began looking for Dugmore at 7 in the morning Sunday. They found his body and UTV in the Little Deer Creek area. Lieutenant Eric Stuckey with Utah State Parks says his body was found about 1,000 feet from the trail. Stuckey says UTVs aren't generally dangerous, but it's up to the abilities of the person driving the vehicle.
There are precautions. This individual did a great job of letting his family know the general area where he would be. And also he was wearing a seatbelt, which is also a great thing to help save lives. But sometimes in these accidents, they are so severe that you sometimes are still ejected out. Also, we do advise people to wear helmets, protective gear, when there are off-highway vehicle use, because all of these factors may help, but sometimes the severity of the incident or crash or accident will determine that.
He also says all the trails in the area have moderate risk to them.
I wouldn't say they're necessarily dangerous, but we do have to be wary of our surroundings and our speeds whenever we are on these backcountry trails.
Authorities aren't sure how Dugmore got off the trail. The accident is currently under investigation. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
The American Federation of Teachers, American Federation of Teachers Utah Chapter Labor Union wants the Park City School District Board of Education to designate one day during the school week to online learning only. The school board is holding a special meeting today to consider an early release one day a week, but does not plan to close in-school learning for a full day at this time. Carolyn Murray has the details.
The AFT, American Federation of Teachers, President Brad Acey says recently he's received requests from Park City teachers asking for help representing their interests to the Park City Board of Education. He sent a letter to the board strongly encouraging President Andrew Kaplan to ease the burden on teachers by implementing one day a week when all students would work from home. He says faculty could work directly with online students to prepare for lessons, and that classified staff could use the day for professional development, safety training, and deep cleaning.
Quite a few are joining. I don't have the numbers right now because I've been on vacation, but it's just been recently where I've had them reach out, teachers reach out. Some of them haven't joined yet, but they've reached out to AFT for help and assistance when it comes to encouraging the Board of Education of looking at a day where it's online teaching. As more members come on board, we'll be organizing a local union.
AC says other districts are allowing a prep day for teachers to manage the increased workload due to online learners and the many quarantined students who are taking classes remotely. He says it also works well for classified employees, which are custodians, bus drivers, secretaries, to deep clean while students are out of the building. He says it's not uncommon for teachers to spend many hours a day after their workday ends working with online students.
We tend to forget that you can load up a teacher a lot with these different modalities. It's enough when you're teaching in a classroom all day and normal face-to-face, but then you're starting to add other things such as adapting lessons to online, being able to reach out to online students, answer their questions via email or a face-to-face chat with them. A lot of that is done after hours.
Park City Board of Education President Andrew Kaplan says he responded to the letter from the AFT stating the school board has the interest of the teachers in mind. They do not plan to shorten the school week, but would consider some kind of hybrid if COVID-19 case counts were to rise.
A full day off isn't an option at this time. If the case counts go higher and or the county moves to an orange level with regards to COVID, we would be looking at a hybrid model. So we have that planned and we would be looking for, you know, at least 1 or 2 days where kids would not be present in school. But at this point, given where case counts are and how well the district has been doing in terms of contact tracing, et cetera, that's not in the card.
Kaplan says they're balancing kids staying in school and supporting teachers during COVID. KPCW contacted the Park City Educators Association for comment on the issues raised by the AFT, but did not receive a response.
You know, the gist of the letter was they want us to prioritize teachers. I think that's something that the board and the administration has clearly made a priority throughout this year, starting with, you know, giving the largest increase in the history of the district in terms of wages to all of our employees. You know, again, on Tuesday, we're having a special meeting to provide some time relief to our educators, and we'll continue to do what we need to work with our educators and make sure that they feel supported and happy to continue teaching our kids.
According to Superintendent Jill Gilday, Park City School District case counts as of October 5th are 12, all coming from Treasure Mountain Junior High and the high school. The board meets in special session on Tuesday to consider a recent survey addressing changing the bell schedule to allow for early release 1 day a week. The intent is to provide planning time for teachers to work with their online students. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
On the line with me now, I have a Utah State Board of Education member, Carol Lear. She's going to be talking about some of this year's ballot measures affecting education, and we'll have an update on COVID-19 impacts in school. Carol, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you so much. So let's talk about some of these ballot measures. Constitutional Amendment G, which is on the ballot this year, is the proposal to amend the Utah State Constitution to end the constitutional earmark of all income tax revenues for education. Since 1946, Utah has dedicated 100% of income tax revenues to education, which was initially defined only as K-12 education, and since 1996 also included higher education. The state legislature voted in March to place on the ballot the question of also allowing these funds to be used for other purposes, specifically for programs for children and for Utahns with disabilities. So what is Amendment G, and what would it mean to taxpayers if it does pass?
Wow, that's a big question. You described it really well, and then it was the amendment was actually tweaked and sort of reaffirmed in July in a special session of the legislature. So there are three pieces to it. First of all, there's the SJR 9, which is what puts the constitutional amendment on the ballot for voters to decide. Then there is the bill HB 357, that is the bill that passed last session, just days before we had this huge surprise of the pandemic, and it was a much better deal for public education, well, all things considered, but it would have increased the WPU, the weighted pupil unit, which is the funding unit for public education. It would have increased it to 6% by 6% from the previous year. That was a huge boost. Never seen that much of an increase in the last, oh my gosh, as long as I can remember, 20 years. So hold that thought on HB 357. And then along came the COVID and pandemic, and all of the increases were off the table as far as the legislature was concerned, because the economy took a hit. Then in July, the legislature passed HB 5011 in a special session. And though a lot of the increases were off the table from before, this new bill added some increases or potential increases, but they were all tied to the voters passing SJR 9. So that's in a really broad explanation. That's where we are now, waiting to see if the amendment that would allow people, individuals with disabilities, to also receive funding from the income tax fund that has been dedicated solely to public education. I don't know if you want me to keep going. Let me just add one more piece. One of the challenges and the biggest concern I have about Amendment G is that this, it would take away the statutory, even though it's not particularly satisfactory, the statutory dedication, or excuse me, constitutional dedication of the income tax only to public education, K-12 and higher ed. It would take that away. It's not the most stable fund. But then what we would get in return, what public education would get in return, are a number of legislative promises. And those promises can be taken away by a subsequent legislature, completely undone. So to have the dedication in the Constitution, however unsatisfactory, is, in my mind, better than legislative promises that we, as we saw this year, went from 6% in March. In April, it became 1% of an increase in granted extraordinary circumstances, but still a real disappointment to public education.
Right. And is this the only ballot issue impacting education this year?
It is. And interestingly, it doesn't even say, it doesn't even talk about the impact to public education, which I find also disheartening, disingenuous. It just says that the Constitution shall be changed, very short. Says the Constitution shall be changed. In fact, let me just read it. And it's in the form of a question. Shall the Utah Constitution be amended to expand the uses of money the state receives from income taxes and intangible property taxes to include supporting children and supporting with people with a disability? It doesn't say at the expense of public education funding, which is sort of bothersome to me, that it doesn't really explain the potential impact on public education.
Right. And we've seen in the past, even with some of these ballot measures passing, I'm thinking of medical cannabis and Medicaid expansion in particular from 2 years ago, there is really nothing stopping the legislature from really going alone and doing this by themselves. Is there anything that the public can do to send a clear message to the legislature on this besides just casting a ballot?
Well, that's the strongest message. And the legislature very much wants this. I feel like, cornered every single one of the education advocate groups, and all of them support it, including the State Board of Education that voted to support it by a 9-4 vote. So not all of us supported it, but it's pretty widely supported, and I think it was because I feel like it was because a gun was held to our heads. It's collectively and individually as groups to say, if you want anything, this is how you're going to get it. But I have real concerns that all the promises are in statute and can be changed by subsequent legislators and legislatures, as we've seen with, as you point out, the cannabis situation, the redistricting, all these changes that are statutory are subject to review every year.
Right. And when would these funds be released for other state non-education programs if this was to pass?
That is a little unclear. We just talked about that in the state board meeting the end of last week. It would happen gradually is what the legislature says. And that's about as much specificity as we get. It wouldn't all suddenly be diverted to individuals with disabilities. But there are about a list of about 10 groups that then would start benefiting from the income tax. And so when we say gradually, it would be over the course of even several years. And certainly, to be fair, the legislature can give public education and individuals with disabilities more money. There's nothing in any of these promises that limits the funds that could go to either public ed or adults and children with disabilities. But it would supposedly happen gradually over several, many years, if we look at what happened with higher ed being added to the constitutional earmark, and you look at that, it was a gradual increase over the last 25 years, but it has always increased. That's maybe the important point. And I think the other thing that's troubling and challenging is pitting public education sort of against putting it in competition with individuals with disabilities, because schools have always served students with disabilities and done that generously and as directed by the law. And now this sort of makes the two groups in competition for a limited amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Is there an estimate on how much money we're actually talking about here?
That's the other thing. Everyone who's doing any estimating has no idea. Especially this year, we just don't know how, because it's all subject to legislative appropriation. The money is shared, we know, but how much money, we just don't know. And they didn't even guess in the board meeting. Somebody threw out a $6 million amount in terms of changes to what public ed would get. But that was very speculative. We just don't know how this will affect public education. And it doesn't account for anything extra that public ed would receive. Part of the last bill I mentioned, HB 5011, the promise was that over time, the part of the bill was that the 6% WP increase that was given in March would be reinstated. So if the legislature really did that, we could see some money coming to education. But the economy is not the best it's ever been. So that doesn't mean there is a lot of money to appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of feedback are you getting from teacher unions or your colleagues on the Board of Education on their support or opposition for this?
Well, like I said, all of the groups that advocate for public education supported Amendment G back in March before all, the world came apart. It looked like to many groups like this would be a better situation than arguing forever about tax reform, do we increase sales tax, which education typically does not like. So they felt like this was a better approach. And we had some promises directly attached, like a 6% increase to the funding unit. So they all supported it. But there have always been those who said, wait a minute, everybody was way behind adding higher ed to the change to the Constitution 25 years ago. And then the last 5 years, everybody's been complaining about it. So I feel like it's I think everyone was cautious about giving up a constitutional earmark, an unsatisfactory or a unstable constitutional earmark, but still an earmark for promises made by one legislative group. So everyone was, I think, cautious, but the groups did support it, and they support it still. Nobody has withdrawn a group support. But there are many other groups, the League of Women Voters. Interestingly, groups that are advocates for individuals with disabilities are staying neutral on the amendment. And I think that suggests to me that even they are uncertain what this will mean for their funding. They're not gung-ho about, oh, great, we get to split money with public ed. They're also taking a wait-and-see approach, those I've heard about. So I think it's just an uncertain year generally, and we all know that. So this just, I think that makes that especially a hard year to change a constitutional earmark that's been in place since, I think it goes back to the 1980s, 1970s.
Gotcha. So will there be measures that go into place to protect the already low funding that comes from the state? Utah is rather infamously the lowest ranked in the country as far as per pupil spending on education.
There are, you know, that's the problem. We keep saying this, but I don't think it sinks into people. There are no protections. We tried in the beginning when the legislature proposed changing this constitutional earmark. Education groups said, so what constitutional earmark are you going to give us in the alternative? What about setting a given percentage of the state budget? Or what about guaranteeing an increase in the weighted pupil unit, a set increase every year? The legislature would agree to no comparative or alternative or constitutional earmark. So there aren't the protections in place are electing people who support public education.
Mm-hmm. So let's
That's the best we can do.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about COVID-19 before we run out of time. The Salt Lake Tribune published a recent report about schools and COVID showing a graph that ranked case counts per student. Is the Board of Education involved in keeping track or following case counts, testing, quarantine, isolation numbers, anything like that?
Very good question. I think the state board is obviously following that too, but there is an interesting tension about who's in charge. The state board has typically let school districts and charter schools. There are 41 school districts and there are 120 plus charter schools. So the state board has typically let those local entities take charge of many kinds of issues as much as they could. And COVID is no different. And so the direction in the beginning was work with your local health department. Do what your local health department says. And that is still primarily the message. And one of the challenges the state board faced is now we've seen five, seven high schools, mostly, I think it was one junior high, reach the point that the health departments have said 15 students in a school who are infected means the school has to change its delivery system to online. And most of the schools have taken the advice of their local health departments. A couple took it reluctantly and took a few days to shut down. But the state board, which theoretically has the ability to withhold funding from school districts and charter schools, has not done that, rather has been encouraging, supportive to schools to say, your health department has health expertise, medical expertise. Follow what they say. We know we all want to be back in school, but students are better off following the advice of health departments. Mm-hmm. And then there's the governor's office who has the bully pulpit but and certain emergency powers, but also doesn't have absolute control over what a school district does.
Right. So what sorts of trends have you seen across the state? Summit County has had an influx of new people to the area escaping COVID. Is this trend statewide?
Yeah, that was a good question. I have not heard of a steady or significant trend. No, I've heard of a few of certain school districts having some influx. I heard anecdotally, because I work some with the High School Activities Association, I heard anecdotally of certain athletes coming from California to Utah because California isn't allowing athletics. But I have not heard numbers. I've not heard of a significant influx from any specific school district. I think there's just a lot of fluidity right now with parents, even from state to state, looking for the best situations for their students. And Utah is keeping its extracurricular activities alive, unlike many states. So I think that is going to be an interest for some people. But I have not heard about it overwhelming or significant trend in that direction.
Awesome. So any other issues covered that you want to tell us about?
There were a number of issues at the state board meeting that were kind of interesting. There's a driver's ed proposed bill. that may change the observation time for some students who are about to earn their, get to 15 or 16 and get their licenses. That's a real targeted but very passionate group of people who are interested in that. The Teacher of the Year was announced, a fellow named John Arthur from Meadowlark Elementary in Salt Lake District, who is amazing, gives real hope to me about young teachers. There are discussions about other kinds of issues, but COVID was the center of our concern, as was the funding prognosis going forward for public schools.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate the time.
Oh, and I appreciate talking to my constituents in Park City. So thank you for the phone call.
Wonderful. Bye-bye.
Okay. Have a good day. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
We have Cheryl Fox with...
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Cheryl, with the Summit Land Conservancy. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Sean.
So let's talk about these two Weber River projects. We are in Pioa and Oakley, is that correct?
Yes.
What would you like to tell us about those?
Well, we're really excited. We've been working with the communities in both Pioa and Oakley for a while to provide access to the Weber River in those communities. This is a situation where, you know, access is difficult and is being lost as residential subdivisions go into that area. So we've been working with a variety of different tools and partners to try to find ways that work for the community, that also work for the landowners, to keep the river somewhat accessible. And it's so beautiful out there, out on the river. I've been out there quite a bit this past summer talking to different people about the work that we're doing. And it's so restorative to get out there and listen to the water bubble along. So we have two projects. The first is called River Bend Park. And this is adjacent to the new campground that the city of Oakley built near their rodeo grounds. So there's this nice little campground there, but it had no access to the river. There was a, you know, a chain link fence, and you could look across and you could see the river, but you couldn't actually get to it. So we've worked with two different landowners, the city of Oakley, Summit County, several private foundations. We got a lovely corporate grant from doTERRA. And now we're in the final fundraising to make that park actually public access, so that if people go to the campground, they can walk through and access the river. So we need about another $30,000 on that one to complete that transaction. We have a bigger project down in Pioa, a little bit downstream. This is called, we call it Marchant Meadows. And in this situation, we are actually buying 106 acres on the Weber River from a family that's owned it for six generations. And they are ready to retire from agriculture. And this is an incredibly iconic and beautiful piece of property. Anybody who rides a bike out on Wooden Shoe Lane goes past this property. It's full of sandhill cranes. There's a heron rookery. There are two branches of the Weber River that run across this property. And we've been actually trying to figure out how to save it for a number of years. And finally, we got a federal grant that will help us do that. But in order to make it happen, we have to buy the property by the end of this month. So we have set out to raise $450,000 from the community, and we are very close to that goal at this point. We need maybe the last $50,000. So... you know, it would be a shame to have all this other funding come to the table and then lose it at the last minute for want of a few hundred thousand, a few tens of thousands of dollars. So we do hope that the community will help with this effort. These lands will be publicly accessible, and people can learn more on our website at wesaveland.org.
Wonderful. So I understand that you have also secured nearly $2 million, $1.8 million, to save the fields as they arrive in Midway and River Road. Can you tell us a little bit about that project? It sounds like you're not done with that yet.
We're not done with any of it. No. So the project in Midway is in Wasatch County, so that's a little bit different. This is the old Mountain Spa property. So it's kind of right in the center of Midway. And if people are familiar with Midway, when you come into Midway, there's a roundabout. If you come in off River Road, and you can stay on River Road and go towards Main Street, or you can go up Bergie Lane towards the State Park. In either case, the open fields on this Mountain Spa property are adjacent to those roads. And the community in Midway was very interested in keeping those open spaces. It's the views across the fields towards Timpanogos. It's the, you know, the rural character of the community in Midway. And so because of that, we were able to secure a pretty substantial, you know, as you say, nearly $2 million from both the Midway Open Space Committee and Wasatch County's Open Land Board. So that's the bulk of the funding that we need. We still do need some funding from the community, about $250,000. So we are reaching out to friends in Midway. We've been working with a group called Pure Midway and others to try to find some people who would be willing to help us get this one across the finish line.
Awesome. So I understand that you've been partnering with Park City and the Bill White Farms to help preserve the McPolin farmlands, and you encourage people to watch this documentary on Netflix called Kiss the Ground. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it's a good informational thing for people to watch?
Yes. So the Summit Land Conservancy has had a conservation easement on the green fields around the McPolin Barn since 2007. And Frank Richards has leased the land and has a lifetime lease and has been mowing that field, which people probably recognize. But a few years ago, we and Frank and Bill White from Bill White Restaurants, Bill White Farms, started doing some regenerative agriculture in the area. And it's been an interesting journey because we've been doing some testing and a lot of discussion in the community about what we're actually trying to do out there. And basically, we're looking to improve the quality of the soils, improve the way water flows across the land, and improve the biodiversity on this property. And all of that will contribute to enhanced soils, which goes a long way to mitigate our problems with the climate. So there's a new documentary out. It's called Kiss the Ground. And, you know, these are difficult times all of us are living through right now. And I would really encourage people to take a couple hours, and I think it's an hour and a half, and just sit down and watch this documentary. It gave me so much hope. I was so inspired. You know, this is what we are trying to do on this property here at the McPolin Farm and elsewhere with other landowners across the county.
Awesome. So could you talk a little bit about kind of the uniqueness of the land here in Park City and Summit County? A lot of it's private property. Utah is kind of famous for being a public land state. Can you talk a little bit about the uniqueness of this part of the state in particular?
Right. I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, Sean. People know a lot in Utah about sort of the battles over our public lands and how they get designated. But in Western Summit County, most of the land is held in private hands. It's private property. So when people move to a place like Park City and they look around and they see all this beautiful open space, it's easy to think, oh, this is federal land. It's Forest Service or BLM or something. And the fact is, it's not. It's private land, which means it's private landowners who are paying property taxes and they have rights to develop. So the people who organized the Summit Land Conservancy back in the late 90s realized that if we wanted to save the open spaces that we all shared and we all cherished, we were going to have to do something to be fair to these private property owners. So we formed the organization, the Summit, that became the Summit Land Conservancy. And our goal was to raise money here to save land here. And that's what we've done. So I know there are a lot of new people who have been moving into the community, and many of them are coming because we do have these terrific open spaces. We've been fortunate to have this organization, Mountain Trails, who can put trails on the open space so we can access it. But this land wasn't protected by accident, and it wasn't protected for free. And as we're coming into the end of the year, I mean, obviously, we've just talked about the projects that we have going on in South Summit and Oakley and Peoa and also in Wasatch County. If we want to save these open spaces, we really do have to gather together and work together. So The Summit Land Conservancy is so grateful for the support that we've had from the community. We've been able to leverage that support and go out and get some big federal grants to help us really do some serious conservation. We love our partnerships with the Community Farm, Bill White Farms, so many other organizations, Mountain Trails Foundation, of course. And but again, we don't do it alone. So I like to say we save land, but we don't save it alone.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Cheryl. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we'll hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.